sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. And today, all the guys are here.
And a girl,
that's true. April's here.
Talking about Bobby for a second. Sorry, confused.
Somewhere in this dress, that's why.
Over here on my right, we've got Martin Bay.
Hi, mate.
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
Next to him, we've got Bobby Sommerfeld.
Hello, Mike.
We've got Andrew Sheps.
Howdy.
And Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
Guys, this is show number 41, and we are all here still.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. 41, too.
I don't know what that says about how busy we are, but at least we made it to number 41.
It's not a good sign that we're all here, really, is it? Not a good sign.
And you know what? Right off the bat, I have to apologize if I'm a little slow, because I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning last night working on a deadline that was supposed to be today. And all of a sudden, in the last minute, the deadline mysteriously got pushed a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, why is it that, you know, they can find this mysterious little amount of time to push the deadline? And you guys, have you ever worked in a situation like that where you pull like some killer hour and right when you're about to, you know, turn the thing in, oh, you know what? You need more time? Yeah, we can give you another day or so. Anybody has ever run across that? Anybody?
I'd say every single project.
Yeah. I think sometimes they'll do that to make sure that we are pushing and working ahead of the game.
You know, I do believe that probably could be true in this case. The crazy thing about that is, if they would just tell you that in the first place, you wouldn't have to.
You'd lay back.
No, you wouldn't have to start the job at 9:30, you know, in the evening and finish at 3. And I mean, I'll be honest. It was, you know, it was a good mix. It wasn't a great mix. It was a good mix, you know. Mm-hmm. Had they let me start it in daylight hours.
Well, that's a true point, isn't it, really? Because sometimes if you have a little more time, you might be able to do a better job as well, you know, instead of pushing it so much.
And the reverse as well. Sometimes you have more time and you really screw it up.
I was just so amazed and a little ticked off when I found out that, you know, I have another day to do this thing.
Well, vent it tonight, mate. Vent it. Let it out. Get angry.
Really?
Go for it.
Just
swear. Do what you want to.
He doesn't swear.
Oh, he never swore, has he? No, that's true.
Anyhow, so if I'm a little off, you'll know why.
Okay.
I want to start off with a couple things. Number one, I got the Sweetwater catalog. I don't know if anybody gets that every, you know, quarter.
Playboy for audio.
In a brown paper bag.
And the techno lust that happens when you see that. And it got me thinking about how do you control that techno lust thing?
Get married.
To like buy every piece of gear out there, except for Rob, because Rob owns every piece of gear.
I was going to say, I have no ability to fight that.
He is the Sweetwater catalog.
But I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was talking about, you know, when these catalogs come in, he just wants to buy everything. And I know in his particular case, he's trying to because he has a ton of credit cards that are all run up. But it got me thinking, you know, there's people out there that I'm sure suffer from the same affliction that we all do, which is, you know, techno lust. And I do a few little things, but I want to open it up to everybody. What do you guys do to control the techno lust when you really see something, you know, especially when the catalogs come? Any particular methods that anybody uses?
I don't actually have techno lust. I truly don't.
Really?
I mean, I go, oh, that'll be nice, but I go, oh, well, you know, whatever. I really don't feel the need. I truly don't.
I think it's called GAS, though, I read. It's called GAS, Gear Acquisition Syndrome.
Wow.
Ooh.
Wow. Wow. For you. And that's the guy who's a technician here, you know. He sat behind us and knows much more than we do.
But Bobby, you don't have techno
lust? No, I mean, you know, I suppose I don't. There's not enough stuff coming out consistently that's a must-have piece of gear.
Right.
Because it's all so much of a muchness these days, and it has been for the last 15 years. Okay, you know, of course, when something really comes out that will help us do our job much better or is just absolutely phenomenal, a new generation of something, then yes. But really, like, oh, another synth comes out with, you know, multi-timbre this and 3 million voices, and I kind of sort of don't really. Matter of fact, it becomes like a bit of an advertising noise. I'm like, oh, whatever, just give me something good, you know, something old and good that does the job, as you know.
Yeah, I can see that. Andrew, what about you?
I bought a console. I mean, I which saved is 35 it up years saved old. It up, and then I popped, and I, you know.
That's
yeah, I don't have. I mean, I had lust after the faster computer or the way of doing the thing I'm already doing faster or better. But I think that, and we've talked about it in relation to every single thing we've ever talked about, especially with music, is that controlling your tools is the best way to be creative with them anyway. So you're chasing after, oh, that'll make it go better. That'll go make it go better. And it just makes you confused. So it took, I mean, it took a long time. But now, yeah, I don't lust after any of it.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't either with your console. I mean, come on. You're just not going to do better than
that. Fair enough.
Scott, how do you control that?
I'm a gear whore. I don't have as much lust as I have to admit as I used to. I mean, going to NAMM show was like just going into heaven and seeing all the toys and figuring out what I was going to buy. I do agree with Bobby, though, that a lot of the products out are, you know, the $350 repackaged software, yada, yada, that you used to have. Or if you want to create the cool Porta Studio, they've got a thousand solutions for that. How to do something small with an incredibly high quality. The question for me a lot of times is looking for that piece of gear that's new, unique, something that brings something new to the game you haven't heard before. And those are becoming much more far and few between, I'm noticing, you know. Especially I've been on big plugins, and I've got the SSL and the Neves and the APIs, and after a while I'm like, okay, you know what, I don't need this, I don't need this, I don't need this. And I do agree that if you start getting too much gear, then it just becomes noise, and sometimes it's better to have a little bit less but really be proficient on it. So I think as I'm getting older, the lust is coming down just a little bit.
Martin, what about you?
It's what the guy said, really. It's the same situation. When I changed over from, you know, the analog room to the digital room, it was all very exciting and I had to learn a lot. So that was all great because, you know, you're going into a totally new territory. But because I'm primarily writing all the time, there was a point possibly about the last 6 months that I just said, that's it. I've got enough EQs. I've got enough compressors. What I was very interested in was guitars and amplifiers from the past. I was still interested in that.
And you bought a couple of guitars.
Yeah,
right?
I did. I bought the some beautiful acoustics that I wanted because I don't usually write on acoustics, so that was new. But as Bobby was saying, it comes to a point when you, particularly when you're being creative, that it's sometimes better to say this is the palette I have.
Right.
These are the brushes I have, and not anything else. And let's make the best out of this, because it does get to the point where there's too many choices, and if there are too many choices, sometimes you don't get to the song. You're just thinking about production all the time. So for me, it's like I already feel I have too much.
Right.
But it's if I go into Guitar Center just for a walkabout, it's dangerous because you're in the brothel as such. You know.
Yeah.
You want to spend some money. So, but I've been very disciplined recently, and I've got to learn the stuff I've already got better.
Right. Yeah.
And said, this is the what I've got to deal with. And then I learned that, how many EQs can we have? It's best to learn three or four that you are really good at. And
14.
You understand them.
14 EQs.
It's actually more fun to actually get more out of what you got. Even if you just limit your, I mean, of course, plugins, you can have millions of them without, even knowing you got something, you know. But in the end, it's like, well, it's a modeled EQ. How different is it? It's like, it doesn't really do that much. It's like, okay, great, I can push treble.
One thing, I've been excited, we talked about earlier, actually before the show, actually from the last podcast. I mean, I've got two studios I work out of. I've got the one at SoundLux and the one at my house. And I've just gotten excited. I just bought a laptop, bought Logic, and the ability to plug my guitar into it. And it's kind of banned in the box. And I like the simplicity. I can go outside. I can go by the pool.
Right.
I can go anywhere. And now it's no longer studio heavy where I get all this gear and I feel I have the need to use it. And now I can kind of go back and, especially on my music side, just kind of go back to the grassroots and explore that way.
Get a little lean and mean. I think people, when they go into Guitar Center and they have this techno lust, and I am totally guilty of this, I think a lot of times you're hoping to buy inspiration. And
that's
true. One of the ways you can help and, save your marriage or save, your relationship is to realize why you're going in there. And if you're going for inspiration, just look for a different place to get your inspiration from.
I have to say also, as the guy who apparently is the most guilty of this year last. No, I agree with what you guys are saying. It's better to have fewer tools and really have them mastered. Part of what I do is I'm always exploring for the latest, newest thing, and it's not just for me. It's for Stevie. It's for sure. other people. So I always have sort of an ear out to what's happening. But I have to say, honestly, I purposely don't receive any catalogs, including Sweetwater. I don't subscribe to any magazines. I mean, I'll check them out on occasion, but I don't like the constant barrage of being sold to, because a lot of times you're being distracted into considering things that you really don't need. What I tend to do is when I decide I have a need for something, I'll go out and look for it. But I don't like the never-ending barrage of catalogs and web advertising magazines. I think it really, a lot of times, distracts you into thinking you need things you don't.
We have to also remember that there's a certain point where, you know, the new technology has got to a certain space. And, you know, every year it's going to be, for the next 10 years, it's going to be, this is what we're dealing with. You know, the tape machines changed, we're in a digital realm. But now how much more is going to change? Like you said, you know, using smaller equipment and riding on the road is an interesting thing, you know. But how much is really going to change now? It was a massive revolution to go to digital. And that,
well, there's
to me,
drums and pianos and...
But there's not a whole lot of innovation going on now in terms of the creativity side of it. The packaging, the size of things, how fast they can run, how big they can be. I mean, that is going insane and will continue to do that. But I think we had a huge revolution in synthesizers, I mean, from the DX7 all the way up, probably till the Karma or something like that. And it seems to kind of level off, and it's just more of the same. And now the things that come out are sound libraries, so you can have 5,000 more samples of the same type of things you've got, but everything's been sampled now. There are several great orchestral libraries where it used to be you'd really hunt for a good orchestral library, and there's just more ways to do the same stuff coming out.
I think you're correct on that, that there are definitely more ways to do a lot of the stuff, but when you're in Rob's position, though, and you need to keep up, or
I
you
need
fall
to
behind.
Keep up, but you know what? I have to also say I've been getting in a lot of songs and tracks from a lot of young songwriters for some projects I'm working on now, and a lot of these are people who are just kind of starting out age-wise and equipment-wise, and they don't have a big palette to work with. A lot of them are using Logic with just the built-in virtual instruments.
Right.
Some are using small workstations and MPCs for drum machines and stuff, but they're all using really basic setups. And I have to say, I'm hearing some of the best creativity I've ever heard. And generally, the smaller their setup, the more creative they've become
with it
because they have no choice.
I just recently
bought a new keyboard, believe it or not. And I'm being the one. It's the first time I've bought. I had old KX88. I still have it, but I wanted to get a better controller because it used to nail my fingers.
But you're not lusting after it, so it's not technical.
But it took me such a long time to find a nice controller. But anyway, I bought this S90, Yamaha S90S, which is really quite nice and useful. But the nice thing about it is what you're saying. It's a self-contained workstation, and I actually do. I've done like great little demos. I even switch on my computer. It's really cool, and I'm like, they do sound more inspired. They're more of a vibe instead of sitting down with all your gear and having like 300 tracks ready to go, and it's like
it's a bit sterile. I've been doing the same thing with an Oasis, which is the same idea. It's just
absolutely
the whole workstation in one box. Don't even switch on the computers. You're forced to use the sounds that are in it, and any of these things have a lot of sounds
and the good sounds.
But they're fine. They're good.
And if you're doing pop music,
it's all you need, and then you can focus on the song and not the technology.
You know, fun is if you like mixing. Have you guys gotten into X keys?
Who didn't even begin. Hit me with some X keys.
Bobby is the king of X keys.
Why don't you tell us what X keys are, Scott?
X keys are these little button controllers, and we've bought we've got some for the feet, some for the hands, and it's great because now
made by a company called PI Engineering.
Yeah, and so we've been buying a whole bunch of them.
That's right.
So I've got like all these macros and plugins. I got feet controllers, so now when I'm mixing, I can play, start, and it's like got all the limbs working. But what it does is it makes mixing turn more into an instrument rather than like a single fader, and the speed of being able to work through whatever you're working through is great. So it no longer becomes, I got to hit this, move the mouse here. It kind of reminded me when I used to work on the Sinclair. It used to be really fast.
Yeah, button for everything.
Yeah.
Well, I use X keys too a bit, and I tried to get Stevie into them, although he's happier with just the built-in computer keyboard. But I've never seen an X key set up like Bobby's. There's a button for everything in his room.
Lights? No, in a
kitchen. Well, you have some big
I've actually been using XKeys for a while, I have a bunch of their controllers, but more importantly, you can buy their Matrix board. And what it is the microprocessor of the XKeys, and you can put up to 128 contacts on it. So, and you choose your own things. That's what I've done. I have that, and I built my own little controller which controls.
Field trip to Bobby's.
Okay. Yeah, I tell you what's scary though. He can control the lights of my house.
I do, especially when I go round.
So we're over here hyping up this new technology as we're trying to tell people not to have a techno.
Yeah, and apparently there is some innovation.
Yeah, but it's cheap. Don't worry.
But the funny thing is, here we go. I mean, and I agree completely that you buy these X keys and it makes everything more tactile. And you're like, oh, yeah, I can hit the button and I press this button and it solos and I press this button and it mutes. It's like, yeah, but we did that 25, 30 years ago. Press this button and it soloed. Press this button and it muted. So it's really not going forward. It's just doing a different box.
Well, I have a couple of suggestions for people who want to get over Technolust, except for people who want to get into XKeys, I guess. The first thing I would recommend, if you have this affliction and you feel like, you know, you have to buy something new, just go back to your own little studio, and I'm sure there's some software, there's something that you don't know everything about that you can find a new way to use it, you know, and I think that's the number one suggestion. My number two suggestion on actually getting over Technolust, and it's a little different than what Rob said, is I would read those catalogs, because sometimes when you just read about something and you feel like you've kept up and you know about it, it's enough to kind of know that, yeah, I'm aware of that. I don't necessarily need it now, but you know that should there be a time where you do need it, you're informed about it. Anybody else have any really quick one-liners to?
Actually, the one other thing I'll say, I mean, I do have a ton of gear, but I have read the manuals for, I won't say every single piece, probably 95, 96% of those pieces. I mean, I've read hundreds and hundreds of manuals because I
have no life.
Yeah, I have no life. But I don't ever acquire any piece of software or hardware without trying to get full benefit of it. And it's so while I do acquire a lot of stuff, I really am trying to learn the
internet. I've never read a manual.
Really?
Ever. I can't read.
Ever. I've read enough for probably everyone at this table.
You know, after I'm the opposite way. I have to crack open the box, get to the gear as soon as I can, start doing something with it, and then get onto the next piece of gear. Mm. And what ends up happening is you learn like 80% of it. And then there's still a 20% that you do. I do agree that you go back a year or two later and you go, I didn't know it did that. Or, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot. I'm pretty intuitive with learning new gear and new software, too. But I always find that by reading the manual, there's stuff in there that, you know, isn't immediately
obvious. Well, it's a big deal to go back and read it after you already know how to use the thing.
Absolutely.
Because if you read it before you start using it, the 20 really cool things, you won't understand at all what they are and you won't remember it.
But I personally enjoy, with a new piece of gear, I enjoy opening the manual, sitting at the piece of gear, and just kind of working my way through it.
Well, that,
but I truly have no life.
He has that. Wow.
I think you hit it on the head, though. People buy... We do want to buy more gear to buy inspiration. That's definitely true. Yeah. And a couple of bits of gear, plugins and stuff like that have really done that for the last 10 years or so. They've been really great bits. You're like, oh, I'm definitely glad I bought this.
But, well, yeah, the first time you played a D50, that for me, keyboard wise, that was like truly revolutionary.
I've just got two D550s for sale. Anybody?
I think when drum loops came onto it, you know, that was a huge way of inspiring.
Drum machines.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I'll trade you two D550s. I have two also.
You want to maybe yours are better.
No, yeah.
We accept donations.
Mine are gray market. They're 220 volt.
He'll give you the manual. No, well,
150, 120s, okay. You beat me, yep. Higher voltage.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us a good segue into the next thing I want to talk about. Recently, I met with a gentleman from DTS, and I'm learning a new aspect of, since I work on a lot of DVD and a lot of...
And you know, DTS is no longer in film.
Okay.
They just dropped the film.
It's good to meet them as they're crumbling.
No, but where they are still heavy and big is in DVD and Blu-ray authoring.
Yeah.
And they were showing me a plugin to do secondary audio mixing against primary audio mixing. So the actual Blu-ray, the actual machines do the mixing. So you don't have to, like, if you have a commentary, you want to play it against the movie. You don't have to re-record the movie with the commentary in the mix and then have it on its own audio stream. What you can do is you can go in and you can mix and make your moves against the primary audio stream, and then using their plugin, encode it to put it on the disc. And so on Blu-ray, you hear your primary audio stream. Mm-hmm. And then if you're going to bring in a secondary audio stream like a commentary, it'll bring it in and the machine will do the dips for you. So every time, you know, if the director starts talking, the machine will lower it based on your
By the machine, you mean the player, the home
exactly.
player?
So it's like a video game where it has a little DSP built into
exactly.
it?
Exactly. It's similar to that. So anyhow, this is a, it was a, it was really kind of cool because you're going to, exactly, you're going to see, you can really see, I mean, you still have to do the mix, you still have to mix it, but then you're actually not given the audio files, you're merely given the mix instructions to the authoring house, and then they're going to mix the secondary audio.
And is that in real time or static?
No, it's in real time. And it's pretty awesome. It's based on Pro Tools. And the cool thing is if you're watching a horror movie and let's say it's in 5.1, you can have, you know, in the commentary, you can have the,
so are you automating, are you automating like in Pro Tools?
Exactly.
And then you export that volume map?
You export it as an AAF, exactly. And the plugin reads it and it puts the metadata in the secondary audio, and that's being read by the player. That mixes the primary audio against it.
Mm.
It's really kind of cool. There's a lot of really creative things that you'll see in Blu-ray discs. But the cool thing was, is when I was done talking and seeing this whole thing, I felt like, you know, I learned another aspect. I learned something new. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking, what was the last thing you've learned in audio that just was totally brand new and you pick it up? What was the most recent thing?
I tell you, a couple of nice ways of working with Nuendo are, what I recently learned was that you can do audio edits, and the edits, you know, however, whatever you do with the edits, and you can export those audio bits that you've edited. Yet the edit file, all the cuts and whatever, are still in the session. So you could import another piece of audio and it would do exactly those same sorts of edits, including all the plugins and everything. So it's really kind of cool for doing batch audio, processing, which is really great. If you have like stems, like, you know, sometimes you have 8 stereo stems and you want to process them or cut them or make them loops or whatever.
Right.
It's pretty useful little fun.
Yeah, because I think, you know, in our business,
software,
we learn tons of things all the time. We just don't realize that we're learning something new. We just, you know, we didn't all start off working on Pro Tools, and now next thing you know, we've got a bunch of Pro Tools expert here or Nuendo, and it was just, it's really interesting just how this learning just comes in stages. So I was just curious, you know. I know Martin, you know, with your Pro Tools, you were all analog and you learned Pro Tools and you're over there mixing and...
You just chose the worst guy in the world to ask about what I've learned
he
recently.
Did. You just learned that your battery is flat.
Somebody teaches me how to use it and I stay the same for at least 10 years. You know, if anything changes in the room, I have a problem. You know, I've got a routine that I am... No, I mean... I'm not as technical as you guys are, you know, so I'm more into the songwriting. But all that's been different for me is putting up different microphones in different places in my house and hearing the difference of a sound on a vocal. But nothing. I mean, I learned a lot from when you put the studio in for me, Mike. I had to learn how to edit with visuals, which was terrific, you know. And I was not sure that I would like that. But I don't find myself. I would have to say it's probably to do with laziness and being a little bit disciplined. And if I learn too much, I stop writing songs.
So ignorance is the key to your career.
Yes, totally. Ignorance is really, really good for me.
Actually, if you look at the CD liners, it says Martin Page. It doesn't say writer's ignorant.
Yeah.
But you know what? I understand what you're saying, but I disagree because when I go to your studio,
it's just because you love me.
No, it doesn't necessarily have to be anything related to technology. It can also be a workflow, and the fact that, you know, I slowly started you started tracking more live percussion instruments, and you started to bring in, you know, you bought their hi hat and, you know, the snare and it's just, you know, these little things, you know, you're slowly changing the way you work.
Totally. I it's a good point what you started that this whole, you know, podcast off on it, but I was buying everything, learning everything to a certain degree that I could use as a writer. And I got trapped where the analog world stopped and I had to move on. And I fought it right to the end. You know, I was doing some of Josh Groban's albums, Only Wants to Do It Still on Analog. And then it came to a point when that wasn't going to work. So I had to learn. I was forced to it. I am working differently, but I've made a point of stopping, upgrading as much as I can, because that's another learning process, because your output slows down. And for me, it's all about output, you know, and and lyrics and emotions. So it's inspiring, but I'm still more interested in if I can move quite quickly to get rudiments down. I have found that the more options I have, the more I might not be writing something which is, shall we say, emotional, and that's what I'm sort of looking for. But obviously, you know, as you're doing it, you learn more, you know. And it's nice because I've got two studios, one that's still analog. And but I find myself going in the shop still trying to find those, you know, the old Vox amps and different microphones because I'm still intrigued by that, you know. I get a feeling that I could get wrapped up in a very small plastic world if I keep on looking at technology, you know. Yeah. I need to get a certain amount of it. Now I ought to get on the bus to get somewhere, but then don't let it overpower you, you know.
But workflow is really important, though. I mean, that's huge. I mean, I've had multiple studios as well, and they're totally for different purposes. Like, one of them is really made for speed of editing and getting my movies done, and I don't have every cool synth plugin in there. And then I've got my other studio, which is more R&D, which has all of the latest, greatest, let's experiment. So I can just go in there and learn. And now with my little mobile rig, right, I want to get rid of all the technology.
Yeah.
And just get, like you were saying, because I love technology, but I get distracted by it.
Yeah.
And I need to just go back and remember what the chords were.
Yeah, what was your, sure, what was the last thing you learned, Scott? What was the last thing that you learned?
You know, I work in several different industries, and one industry is forcing me to constantly learn, and that's games. So I'm learning what's called middleware software called Weiss and FMod, and these are softwares that actually make games run. So, and it comes out every 6 months, you know, and right, there's new versions. So there's a part of me that is forced to keep up with that technological, you know,
slope.
I tell you, there's a really good point to make that as a songwriter, is that you can't not just sit back and say, you know, I'm not going to learn about certain things. You have to. You have to. For me personally, you have to understand. You have to get what you believe to be the rudiments, and right, so you understand, you know, how to drive the car to a certain degree.
Sure.
And I think every writer, you know, needs to have that. Otherwise, you get left behind. And luckily, surround yourself with people, you know, that know a bit more about it. And like I have found you guys. So you get, if you get stuck, you can also make a phone call and say, I need to do this. But, you know, I'm talking to the writers out there that are just saying, well, I'll stay in my same place. Well, you can't. You know, you have to learn a certain amount. The skill is learning when to stop the tap running and say, I've learned enough to get the car going.
So next time you call, I can just say, Martin,
you can tell me anything, Mike, I would follow it.
I think the danger for writing and technology, because obviously, essentially, what we end up doing is using technology and writing, and either doing once when you're not having a creative moment in writing, you end up disappearing into the manual or looking up new features in your box. You're going, oh, you know, you're not coming up with the middle eight or whatever. You're writing, and you're not. It's very easy to be distracted by this technology,
right,
because it actually gets you away from this challenge that's kicking you in the butt at that time,
right,
not coming up with any ideas, and that can be a real big problem. I think it's real useful for a writer to actually realize this is a hammer and I'm going to use it to beat a nail in. But if I've got no ideas, then let me not screw around, because it just takes your head off in the wrong, lots of times in the wrong direction.
Right. Andrew, what was the last thing that you learned in audio? Andrew knows.
That's what it is.
How to fix the Neve console?
I've learned a little bit about that. I guess having got my modular synth, which breaks all of these. Because normally with plugins or any processing boxes, there are 1,000 things inside that box, and you get some knobs and controls, some of them. With a modular synth, you get one of those things, like a filter or a phaser, but the phaser doesn't even sweep by itself. You know, you have to plug in an LFO to do it. And so learning, kind of relearning a lot of the fundamental stuff, right, about synthesis and audio, and having a lot of fun because you use it differently when it's not prepackaged for you.
Sure.
So
that's a great point, yeah, you made, yeah, about having fun as well. I mean, that's, yeah, a huge thing. You know, it keeps you interested.
Rob, what was the last thing?
Actually, the thing that I kind of was reminded of recently is we've been spending a lot of time recently trying out a lot of different microphones and different mic pre's with different singers who have been very gracious about being willing to try a whole bunch of different combinations. And we're trying some really, really high-end mics and really fancy mic pre's and A-to-D converters and everything else. And all the stuff sounds great, and there are different combinations that sound slightly different. But what I'm reminded of in these tests that we're doing is that once you get up into the fancy stratosphere of gear, a lot of the differences become so minor compared to the difference between a good melody or a bad melody or a good singer or a bad singer that really you can drive yourself crazy with high-end tweaky gear, and you can easily lose sight of what's really important, the singer, the melody, the song, all of that stuff. Anybody who lusts after, you know, a $10,000 mic pre or a $15,000 A to D converter should know they're good.
You better have a $200,000 thing to record with it.
Exactly.
That's so true.
But the thing is, though, you can get out of much less expensive gear a sound that's not as good, but definitely, definitely good enough. And it's just amazing. Once you get into the really tweaky mic pre's and stuff, they all sound good and they all sound different, but none of them is going to save a bad song and none of them are going to ruin a good one.
I think that's why this engineer, I mean, there's two parts to that, though, components. And that's why I think there's some people that really want to write the songs, and then there's somebody who wants to be able to record.
No, that's true.
And capture those songs. And they really, you know, the mic pre's and the mics and how to place it and the room acoustics and that little place in the room that gets that extra little sound. Most composers would be like, yeah, whatever. It's not my thing. Meanwhile, the engineer, that's all about what they're thinking.
I'm saying buy something that's reasonably good if the budget is limited and learn how to use it better than anyone else on the planet and experiment with it and try it in every single part of your room.
I've been in tons of situations where it's more about get an SM57 in on the floor in that room because someone's about to play and you don't have time to set it up.
So there's a lot of that.
Just get it.
Have you ever been to gearsluts.com?
It's
a great site. I like that. I love that site. But the thing about it is every once in a while you read some of the posts and some of the arguments that some of the people get in on and what they flame each other with, you know, slew rates of amps and things like that. It's just, it's really mind boggling. You're wondering, what is this guy recording where he's just so concerned about that
stuff?
Exactly. I agree with what Rob says, you know, get your gear, learn it, you know, and it's what you do with it. It's not the
And also you're going to find gear that it becomes your favorite. That you like to use, that you want to trust, and that's really great.
Love the saying, no one walks away singing the snare drum, you know, basically.
Yeah,
that's true. All right, well, I'll tell you what, this is a good place for us to break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a few other things, and one of the things we're going to talk about is ethics and audio. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And you know what? We lost an Englishman.
Oh, no.
Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Wait, was that supposed to be Martin Bobby?
It was, actually.
Yeah, well, if Bobby wasn't so late, we would still have Martin here, but he had to get going.
Oh, nice.
And thank God I'm here only because Andy decided to talk me in. I was lost on victory.
That's right, because you've only been here 19 times.
But, you know, it's a grid system. I just don't pay attention to the value. I just block it out.
You've got to get a nav system, you know, the audio technology.
That's true.
That's right. GPS. We're going to start the GPS fund for Bobby. Well, hey, listen, guys. I wanted to talk about ethics in audio. And this was actually brought to my attention by a correspondence I was having through one of our listeners out there. And so we started talking back and forth about ethics, and he started asking some questions, and I just kind of wanted to bring it to the panel here and see how you guys feel about some of these things. Now, when I'm talking about ethics, obviously there's the work ethic, where you do a good job, get paid for it, the whole thing, and everybody here, I'm sure, has been screwed by an employer or two. But but for instance, let me ask you guys this question right off the bat. Would you let a friend, if you had an extra install on a piece of software, would you let a friend install that software on their computer?
Good question. Well, incriminating.
And you know what?
Yeah.
Let me put it, should you, okay? So that way it's more like...
Should you or would you?
It's more... We don't have to make it personal because, quite frankly, you know, no one is perfect in this place, and I'm not saying that we are, but these were just some really good questions.
It's good questions. Great question. And the answer is yes. yeah, I've actually done that, unfortunately, and have... I've got to say that when I was starting out, I was definitely more into that. And but as I've gotten to make money at it, I've actually I buy everything. So
I think it is. It's just the natural way of things that when you're starting out and you're young and money's tight, you know, you're more likely to want to just trade software and try out different software. I will say, you know, it's not nearly as easy as it used to be to just trade crack software with
iLock. I can crack it for you. Oh, sorry, Kevin.
I mean, I think that I've gotten to see – I have so many friends who work at manufacturers of software.
Right.
And I get to see just how much money they spend to develop the stuff and how many people are involved in it. And for the most part, software these days is pretty reasonably priced compared to what the comparable hardware would be or even what that same software would have been a few years ago. So I like when software lets you install multiple versions for yourself.
Right.
And actually, sometimes it bothers me if it limits you to two installs because you might legitimately have two or three rooms that you yourself go between, or you might have two laptops.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That bugs me when they limit that, but I don't trade.
Then I do. I just rip it off in that case. I just pirate it completely and post it. No, I don't. I tell you one thing, talking of it, there's an app called a buddy of mine was in my studio and he said, "Can I use your Mac? I want to download something." I said, "Sure." And I didn't know what he was doing, but he installed LimeWire.
Right.
And I didn't realize. He said, "Check this out." And he showed it to me, and it's amazing. I mean, he was just, like, downloading this. I was thinking, oh, he's like a peer-to-peer thing. What is it? He said, no, it's all free. And he was just downloading tons and tons of stuff. And he was, and I said, you know, and I've pulled it off my computer now. I said, look, I'm not too cool about that. Because that was really just massive amounts of sharing. I mean,
bringing down pirated software, or he was bringing down content?
Have you spoiled the website?
No, I mean, and it was crazy because I looked in my iTunes folder, and there was a folder, and it was just tons of MP3s of just bands, you know, just like all sorts of stuff.
And that
for me, I'm going, like, you know, this is really unfair because it's just so much stuff.
Well, I think, you know, I wanted to bring up this ethics because this is just an example of ethics in audio. And I mean, there's a lot of other ways that challenge us as people in audio, you know, all the time in our ethics. For instance, how many people have been tracking and have tracked somebody when they don't know they're being recorded? I mean, have you ever done
just
that?
Just a couple of times. I had a nice instance with this. I was tracking an orchestra, and the arranger came and he said, "We've got to do another take, right?" And I said, "Okay, right." I don't know what that meant. Mute the group of monitor and recut them on another set of tracks, and we did. And the lead violinist came in and said, "Can I listen to that pass back?" And I pressed play, and they listened to it. And they said, "That's not the pass we just did." And I said, "You sure it is?" They said, "No, it's not." And it wasn't. And I said, well, I don't know how that could have happened. And anyway, so we got caught doing it. And how they did it was there was a big old couple of bars rest, and they tapped on their mic music stand in that thing because they asked me to solo the first violins.
Ooh, busted.
So wait, you were supposed to record it?
Well, you were double tracking,
no,
right?
No, well, with an orchestra, you have to – if you say – screwed up and we need another take, they're obliged to play it again. Right. But if you do it to get a double without paying them for a double, they have to get paid twice if you use two recordings of them. So that's a union musician's rule where if you keep both recordings, they have to get paid twice because it's as if they've doubled themselves.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Wait,
you can only use half an orchestra and they keep doubling?
Yeah, they hire smaller string sections than they need and say, we need another take.
They get paid per take?
Yeah.
Well, they get paid per take that you use. If someone screws something up, they will they'll play it all day until you say, okay, that was good enough. But you're technically only supposed to keep one take of the performance.
So in the old tape days, you would re-record over it?
No, you just have parallels.
You'd have a second set of tracks. You ready those up.
And I gotcha.
Okay. Now we're living in my world. You know what I'm told they used to do in the old days?
Wow.
I've heard this. When they'd be using like Sony 48 tracks and stuff.
And you heard this from yourself?
From people. I heard this from people. They would just put multiple, because a lot of times the orchestra's playing to a guide track. They would just stripe the tape with multiple copies of the guide track. So you might have five or six passes on the 48 track tape. Each one has identical time code and guide tracks. So each time you're done a take, instead of hitting rewind, you hit fast forward. And then you would move to the next piece of time code, I'm told. And then you could record another pass, even 48 tracks wide or whatever.
Wow.
Or 46 tracks wide if you had a stereo guide. So instead of rewinding after each take, you'd fast forward and then you'd have a clean piece of tape and you'd actually be saving all of those takes, I'm told.
And that's what we do now, actually. I mean, that's...
Well, with Pro Tools...
Well, in Pro Tools, yeah, you take, do multiple passes, and you do keep them, and they know you keep them.
Because you're comping, and you don't put them under the... Also, you don't put them under the microscope. Say, okay, let's skip bar 72, please. Right. Let's skip bar 42. You go, okay, listen, just play the B section again. Play it three times. I'll comp it. And that
they're
way
generally
of
okay with it now, too.
Now they are.
Because there's nothing you can do.
Definitely.
Now, let me ask you, what do you guys use as your moral compass working in the whole audio game? What do you have any rules, or do you just kind of go by individual situations? I just gave these two out. I got a couple other things I'm going to ask you. But, like, for instance,
I think personal profit and crushing the competition. wait. Moral.
How many people
kidding.
Have a copy of a sound effects library that they didn't buy?
Well, that's actually
one of my CDs in my trailer trash music library is sound effects, SFX. Yeah. But I hear the thing all over the place all the time, and it's like, forget about it. It's like catching sand dropping out of a colander. I tell you, you just can't. It's like, you might just give it away now.
But my question is, what do you guys use as your compass for the ethics? I mean, what keeps you, are you results driven? Like, well, if this is going to affect only me, or is it going to be the outcome? Or, I mean, because these are decisions that come by all the time that we don't think about. And I know for myself, it's changed. Like, when I was starting off, just like everybody else, boy, I was doing the whole peer-to-peer thing and I was trying to get, you know, software. And quite frankly, a lot of the software that I used, I ended up buying, but not all of it.
Because I was part of that era as well, there was no demo material.
Right.
So it was like, I remember days with the Commodore and the Atari, and a lot of times it wasn't like, I want to try it.
Sure.
You bought it. It sucked. You spent your money. You're done. And the only way to really see if something was good was say, hey, yeah, let me see a copy of it. You tried and said, this is great. I'm going to buy this.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there was that, but there was also, it was just out there and you could download it. And now as I get older, I look at a lot of these decisions that I make as well, who's this affecting? Well, it can be affecting if I, you know,
it affects us,
version.
Really.
Well, yeah.
Because the prices we pay for everything is going to go up because people are not making enough money on what they're selling.
Right. And you meet the people like Greg, you know, if you crack.
From Steinberg.
Exactly. Use crack software from Steinberg, then, you know, Greg works for Steinberg. And, you know, you just start looking at the consequences.
That's what I do. I put myself in the mindset, or from the perspective of the people working for the company because, you know, all of us in some way or another are content creators ourselves, whether it's for a movie or a game or a record or whatever, an album, I should say, not a record, except maybe Andrew's still making vinyl records.
Yeah.
He wishes.
Every once in a while.
But, you know, we're all content creators and we're all creating content that's going to be stolen.
Right.
And I can remember 20 plus years ago coming up with samples and DX7 sounds and stuff for Stevie that I ended up hearing on other people's records, you know, eventually. Everybody's going to have their stuff you know, bootlegged at some point. And I try to, when it comes to software, it's not that hard for me to put myself in the mindset of whoever created it. And most of the time, software these days is so cheap. It's gotten so competitive. Yeah. You can get a sound library for a few hundred bucks that, you know, would have cost thousands.
No, but you know what's great, though?
Or you can get it for free.
You know,
from
you've
Bobby.
Been around long enough. When I did a movie and I was doing a sequel to a movie, and this guy goes, oh, you got to hear the original. This stuff's great. This guy came up with this great stuff, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, let me listen to the movie. I listened to the movie. It was all my stuff. So I said, actually, he got it from us.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know. It's
oh, I will just say one other thing just to in line with your story. Last year we got called to do a knockoff of a piece of music that we had actually done originally. That they were using. I mean, they were using, but they were worried whoever had done it originally would find out, and it was actually us.
That's funny.
So they called us to do it.
That's pretty funny.
And so you found out.
And you said,
we did find out.
I'll license it to you.
No, we didn't. We did a new one and charged them, and we did tell them eventually it was us that we were ripping off.
That's pretty funny.
That's fine, as long as we get paid again.
Okay, here's the situation. Can you use a crack if you own the license?
I know a lot of people who do that.
Okay, I'll tell you something right here. Nuendo, I love Nuendo, and I love that product, right? But their crack works better than their licensed product, and that's sad. It's because they have a dongle on their product that slows the performance of it down a lot. and their crack, I saw it on somebody else's machine and it smoked. And I was like, you know something, it's not fair. We're paying $2,000 a product and this guy's got it for free and he's getting better performance.
Same version?
Yeah, pretty much.
That used to be super true in the Pro Tools OS 9 days where all the protected plugins ran way, way slower than the crack ones.
Yeah. When I used to use Serato Pitching Time, I use it all the time. They had a little thing that after about a year, after you bought it, it would shut down and say that you need to reauthorize it.
Yeah.
After you bought it.
Yeah.
And the crack was all over the place.
Right.
So I called them up and they said, well, you know, we want you to license it. Blah, blah, blah. I said, no. I'm on a stage. I need it now.
I know that.
I said, why am I dealing with you? I already paid you my money. I can go to the crack and not deal with this at all.
Right.
Yeah, it was a huge, huge.
No, that's so true because that plugin, guy, it seemed like every 3 months I was authorizing that thing because I used that same thing and it was in the most inopportune times when you find out your plugin doesn't work.
The iLock really has helped a lot of that.
But
as much as I hate the way Pace develops stuff.
But look at the iLock though. I mean, your iLock is, my iLock has tens of thousands of dollars worth of plugins on
it. Did you insure it?
Yeah, I mean, you can insure it, but you know what? Not for everything, though. That's the thing. And so certain bundles, you know, if you don't want to take your iLock with you, there's a crack out there for it. And so, but is that right?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes. Well, the market demands it. I mean, you know, basically every generation is stolen at different levels. And unfortunately, technology has made it so easy for everybody to steal now.
Well, but at the same time, you're keeping the crackers, you know, cracking.
But to answer that one specifically, you still adhere to the terms of the software license. It doesn't say to install the copy-protected version that you've bought in this box.
Right.
It says you can install it on your computer. So if you choose to install a different version, I mean, it's a bizarre ethical, philosophical argument. But I think in terms of like the actual legality of it, you're not doing anything wrong unless you install it on more computers than the license says.
The unfortunate thing is the crackers are not allowed to change the code. It says in the agreement, you're not allowed to alter this code or distribute it.
Right.
Obviously, they are.
I mean, the crackers have, but you are installing. I don't have a problem with that. Now, obviously, when you go past.
No, I understand.
You know, if you say, well, I would buy it, but I'm running the crack. Well, that's a different situation.
No, I totally believe it. And I think we all know what kind of bundles we're talking about.
But I think with the iLock now, I mean, I don't have any software where it would benefit me.
Yeah.
To run a crack instead of the
iLock. Just take the iLock with you. Yeah.
I don't like actually running cracks ever because there's always like something goes wrong.
You need to be able to yell. You got to be able to call up and yell. You know?
That's true.
I think a lot of the progression that we've all talked about is we start off, we're using more crack things, but we're not actually generating income for ourselves or for anybody else at that point. And as soon as we start making money, I think we all, at least the people in this room, got smart enough to say, I really need to own it because I need to yell or I need to feel legitimate.
And I have used cracks.
I want the next version.
That's enticed me to use the product. I didn't ever like the product. I had a crack of WaveLab that I was not mad about. Anyway, and I started using it. I thought, man, this is a great program. And it came out, which was on an iLock, and I said, I'll buy it. I bought it, which is one way around it.
You bring up a really great point, Andrew, is when you start making money. When you start making money on somebody's software, you know, you better start paying.
Absolutely, because otherwise they're going to go away.
Yeah, there's no argument for not buying a piece of software that is actually making you money.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
And also, it's the price. You know, it used to be when it was $10,000 and, you know, you can only buy one. But now everything's $349. Right. I mean, just pay the money. I mean, it's like, be done with it.
Okay, here's another question. Should you lend a friend your sound effects library?
You can't. It's illegal. Speaking as a sound effects guy,
exactly.
Because there's actually a license on the back of that.
Right. But I know it's illegal, but I'm just saying, you know, if your friend's doing some demo or doing,
you know what,
a
I will say that there have been times, and luckily Scott's across the table from me, there have been times when a friend has called and said, you know what, I need a door slam.
Right.
Or I need something like that. And I've helped them out.
He shut the door in his face.
Giving them the library.
I can't say too much on this, but some major corporations have all hit us with multi-license deals, and we didn't even ask. They just said, because they're exposed. I mean, you could sue the pants off them. And everybody, there's always a disgruntled employee who's willing to spill the beans. So what they said is, hey, look, we have it. We want to make this clean. What would it cost to put this on, you know, 10 servers that serve a whole lot of people.
Sure.
What's the cost? And then it's a yearly service cost. And but I think
it's different than someone asking you for a sound or two. That's actually multiple people.
Yeah,
right.
Using
it
for real. I mean, there is a difference.
It depends. If it's something that I got in my house, it took me 2 seconds to do, great. If it was a once-in-a-lifetime Bengal recording of a Bengal tiger that all the planets aligned to get this one sound, there's no chance in hell I'm going to give it out to anybody.
But it only costs what? Your animal effects library is like $500? It's pretty.
No. But if you actually think about it, let's take, everybody wants our Black Hawk Down library. All the guns, all the tens of thousands of dollars we spend
right.
to get the guns, to get the time, the people, all the recorders, all the people, all the investment.
Right.
And people just say, hey, can I buy it for $100? No.
No.
Go get it yourself.
I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying your prices are reasonably priced because when I got the Animal Effects Library, it's a great library. There's a lot of great animals in there. And if you really need, whatever it is.
If your living depends on those sound effects, you need to buy it, just like the software you're going to use to place them.
But, the same thing happens with us. I mean, we get called to do a demo. Can you do a demo? We don't have a budget. Can you write a bit of music for us? We're going to try and get it sold. If we get it sold, we'll come back and pay to do it. It's sort of kind of a little bit like that when we end up using, when we did use software that was either free or we'd got a copy of it. When we ended up starting making money out of it, we'd go back and buy it. I think, we also do that as writers. We end up doing work for free
right.
and giving it to the people for free for them to go and try and go and get something out of it. And if they hopefully make some money, they'll come back and employ us to do the job, or at least pay us for the job we've already done.
Well, the question that you asked, Mike, was not, is it okay to steal a sound effects library? Is it okay to give a friend some sound effects? And at that point, it's the decision of the guy who is the license holder for the sound effects, whether he wants to give away a few sounds. I'm not talking about giving away the whole library.
No,
I'm talking
understand.
About if someone asks you for a door slam. And like in Scott's situation, he would never, if someone asked, for his custom Bengal tiger recording, he would just say no.
Right.
But is it a huge ethical problem if someone asks Scott for a door slam and he decides to give him a door slam or two? I don't think so.
You know what's really common, and I think I did it both in music and in post, and that is what we call it, trading closets. And that is, I have something that I don't use and you have something you don't use, and it doesn't matter if one was $10,000 and one was a buck. Let's trade my garbage for your garbage.
So and I'll trade anything in my closet for anything in your closet, because I've seen your closet.
You'll end up with a bunch of old Ataris, Mike.
But you know what? It's like Radar O'Reilly. I mean, there's times where we'll sit there and say, look, we'll need to get your elephant recordings for our car library. But then it's bartering. Then it's saying, I've got something of value that I... And then I will, barter with you for something else.
Sure. Well, as long as the two parties doing the bartering are both the owners of those
that's
sounds.
True.
Not, you bought the Hollywood Edge Library and I bought Sound Ideas and then we're going to trade. That's not.
Here's a question for this group then. And the answer is, if I was asking myself this question, yes, I did do this, but I have somebody that works with me, was working with me on a project, and he had his own studio, and I was working at his studio from time to time, but mostly at my place. But it happened that we had to do some stuff at his place, and he didn't have my sound library. He didn't have my orchestral thing. So I gave him my orchestral library to install on his system, although it was one of my licenses. There's nothing else I could do. It's like, what else can I do? Go and buy another library for him to use, and I had to take it off there when I'm done, because if I need a license. So what would you do in that situation?
I don't know.
Because technically I'm not allowed. I'm not supposed to do it, I suppose.
But it's for a project for you. I mean, he's working for you, and it's the only way you're going to be able to get the work done.
Yeah. Exactly. Because they license it to the machine. Sorry, they license it to the machine specific. But it's like, that's crazy, because, I'm not going to take my computer over to his place.
I don't know. I would equate it to a facility buying a sound effects library. The facility buys it, and people who work for that facility on projects that the facility does.
And then every editor works in every workstation downloads the library, has their copy, goes to another facility.
Well, I mean,
it's like pollination.
Yeah, but that's not right, But if you
but the reality is, like, for sound effects wise, that's how all the sound libraries got started. Yeah. The Universal libraries, the 20th Century Fox libraries, everyone just had copies of copies of copies.
You know, it's a very cool thing. I did a music library, one of a couple of music libraries, and I found that people could rip them off quite easily. Mm-hmm. And you know what I did? I recorded myself saying "Summer for Music" and copyright "Summer for Music." I said it quite quickly, and then I sped it up to like a silly speed, so it's just like tick, you couldn't really hear it. And I put it in the track. And then if I slow that track down by like 6 octaves, it goes. You hear like Summerfield Music. You hear it in the background.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It's all grainy, but it's very cool. So if ever you really want to get
watermarks,
yeah,
digital watermarking is something we should probably talk about some podcast, because that is a way to, at least if your stuff gets ripped off and used in any way that actually generated some big money for somebody, you can go after them.
I've got one more thing before we're going to wrap up because we're running out of time here, and this has to do with.
Jail time.
No. if you go on Craigslist and you look at the employment and you see, and I feel sorry for picture editors, because you look at the employment and you see editor wanted, editor needed, editor wanted, editor needed, and then you read the post, you know, there is no pay, terrific opportunities, yada, yada, yada. Should you ask people to work for free?
Not if you're making money. Absolutely not. Not if you're making money.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, if you're not making money and you need someone's help and they believe in what you're going after,
right,
then maybe. But if you're making money, it's...
Or if you're training someone as an intern, okay, you know, then absolutely. If someone wants to sit with me and watch me work and is willing to do that and do a little bit of work...
Well, they're being paid with education.
Okay. Yeah.
They're
right. But even that, I mean, I've had a couple of interns and I always end up giving them money. If they're sitting around while I'm making money, I always give them, you know, oh, here's $50 for the day. Thanks for whatever. But, yeah, you got to – Bobby's got to look
now,
up his
I worked
face.
For 13 months, really, in a studio as an assistant engineer for free. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
As an intern or
like- – As an assistant engineer. I started off – I was actually doing front-house mixing, and I had a pretty good understanding of mixers and everything, and I also helped them in the technical department fixing their harmonizers and stuff. I had electronics background.
Right.
I worked there for 13 months for free, not 1 cent.
And do you feel that's all right?
You know, I learned a lot. I did
See,
learn.
That's the key.
I learned a lot. I learned everything I needed to know about a studio. I learned how to maintain a Neve. I learned so much stuff from all the good guys there. And it gave me a break in mixing. I got a gig. I actually broke in. The first engineer didn't rock up one day. He had a break up with his wife, and they put me in the hot seat, and I carried on, and I got the gig, and I stayed on. And I stayed there for a good while, but...
Well, when you're getting an education that you would have,
but I must say, it's not an education at first. I mean, sitting in the background and saying coffee, tea, anybody, you know, and then eventually tape hopping in those days it was called. I mean, I did learn eventually, but it took 6 months to learn something.
I would have loved to have seen you asking for drinks. What was that like?
It's quite easy, really. Anybody want something? Because I'm getting one. No, I'm a very good subservient engineer, believe it or not.
I look at these ads on Craigslist, and you see, you know, terrific, you know, independent film done by the director of so-and-so and the writer of such-and-such. Terrific opportunity for you looking for somebody with their own Final Cut Pro system, yada, yada. And I'm just like, man, it just takes a lot of nerve to ask for somebody to do this without even, like, you know, tossing them a bone. You know, $50, pay for the gas, pay for the tape. I'll buy him a drive, you know? Yeah. You know, anything. I just, I don't know. I think
to expect someone to show up with the knowledge and the equipment is... I mean, if it's a student filmmaker who's done it for free, I mean, then it's all fun because you're all in it together. But yeah, when it's like, yeah, this guy directed blockbusters, you should come work for him for free.
I don't think.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like, I'm totally polarized on this. If you're going to work for somebody who's making a lot of money from you because you're cheap labor or no labor,
right?
Then I'm against that. If there's opportunities where, like, I'm in a situation now where
China,
some big producers, and we are getting paid, but some big producers, a gentleman's wife, and she's also a producer, is doing a first directorial. I know that they got a little bit of money and they're doing it out of their own pocket. Could we cut them a serious deal?
Well, now, that's fine.
Wait, but then there's some people that I know that are young that said, God, I would love to learn how to cut Foley. Well, I have a choice. I can have somebody who I know can do it really fast, no big deal, and pay them. Or I can give somebody an opportunity who's never done it, do it 3 or 4 times, get it wrong. So from the educational aspects, I'm actually for it because that's how people.
But I think that that falls into what I was talking about before with an intern. I mean, that's like hiring a fully intern.
It's, yeah,
exactly. Right. And if you can afford to slip them a little bit of cash, great. And if not, fine. But you don't put them on a big budget movie either.
Exactly.
You never do that.
I agree with that.
But I got to say, it does happen here a lot because of its so-called Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many people come here, unfortunately, with stars in their eyes.
Yeah.
And these guys and girls are looking there to prey on them, and then they hang big old carrots out.
But you know what I'm finding is really tough? And I get about 10 resumes a day. I mean, it's crazy how much we get.
Did you get mine?
I did, yeah. And one of the problems we're having, and some of these people are decent, our budgets now are so tight and are so small that we had a company meeting about this, that we can't afford not to use the top best talent because we need it fast. And we need it right. And as a sound supervisor and I have a crew, I don't want to be worrying about the basics.
Right.
Like I just I'm going to get so-and-so. It'll get done in the next 5 days. I don't worry about it. And it'll be done right. It's just not an issue. And I got all these people saying, give me an opportunity, I'd love to get in, blah, blah, blah. And what we're starting to find is that there's no money even paid to give these people opportunities to figure it out.
Right.
To be on it, because I don't either have the time or I don't have the budget to play that game. And it's very difficult from when I first started of how to get into it. On the other hand, I saw a gentleman who learned transfers, worked in it for 2 months, totally for free. He's now running post to Warner Brothers.
Hmm.
So talking about an investment, it really depends. Yes, I totally agree. There are sharks out there. There are people that prey on these people. I mean, reality TV is huge. I mean, picture cutters, they're not union. They work them all the time. They don't pay them that well. Use them, abuse them, at least from what I hear.
You know what? It's a tough one. But I think what it can ultimately come down to is their value going back?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be monetary. It sounds like Bobby, you know, you've got the education. Scott, you give them the opportunity.
I think if people don't take advantage of people unfairly, if it really is, as Andy said, if somebody's getting something from it, like a good education from first class, world class people, and you're not going to learn that at a school.
Sure.
It's worth a lot of money. It's worth $20 an hour for them to pay you. You know,
which comes right back to the ethics discussion. I mean, and you need to look at it in a broader picture, because your description of getting people in to work for no money, but there's money in the project, and then you say, oh, well, that's China. Well, it is.
I mean,
that is exactly the description of a globalized economy, but you have to look at, well, what are they getting out of it? And if you start looking at the wages in China, and we're not going to go into it at all, then you can start making a decision about whether it's ethical or not. And there's some people who will decide they won't buy goods made in China based on that information.
Right.
And other people say, compared to what they can make doing something else, it's fine. But you need to look at it ethically and put yourself in the other side of it, too.
Yeah,
and just make sure you're good with it.
Well, I just want to wrap this up really quick, but the last thing I want to say is, as you go out and you work in audio and you're doing your thing, if you're a musician and you're going to start complaining about people ripping off your music, check your computer and make sure that you have all your authorized software up and running and no cracks, because it's a big giant community and what goes around comes around.
That's
so, so I think on that note, we'll wrap this up. So, guys, Rob, you doing anything that you...
Well, I do have a slight announcement to make. It's not a huge one, but I am happy to report that 3 pieces of furniture showed up at my house.
Oh, my God.
Now, wait. No. Hold your applause. It's the first 3 out of 14.
And it's couches for the living room?
No. They're really, really, really tiny little things like speaker
stands. Is it a stand with no
stuff,
table?
Do they look good?
They look great. And there should be more coming soon, and there's still a few things that need to be worked out, but I'm just happy to say something showed up.
That's great. And you know that as soon as it all gets there, Rob Studios is going to be the first in the Audio Nowcast video series.
Yep. Christmas 08.
That's great.
Andrew, it should be soon.
Andrew, you working on anything?
Just some general stuff. Nothing to report, really.
Nothing come out this past week?
No, because I think we mentioned Nicole Atkins last time.
Right.
I think that came out. So, no, nothing new.
Scott, are you working on anything?
I'm still on the Express. I'll probably be on it till the end of January. But one good thing is we are launching the L.A. chapter of the IESD, Interactive Entertainment Sound Developers. And we are throwing our first networking function party over at Tadio at Lantan in Santa Monica, December 5th.
We'll be there.
December 5th. And SC Electronics has given us mics to raffle off. We'll be raffling off Hollywood Edge libraries. Sony, Microsoft has given us a ton of stuff. And right after that, we're going to be doing the same thing in Seattle and then in February in the Bay Area.
That's great.
So it's that's starting to launch in a pretty big way, and quite excited about it.
That's great. Bobby, you working on anything fun and exciting?
I'm actually at the stage of making CDs, can you believe? I told you guys a couple of weeks ago, Trailer Trash, this music library I've been trying to get going, eventually got picked up, and the people now, because it's going out throughout the world, need CDs. So at the moment, it's 7 CD set, and I have to make 1,500 of them each, so it's like...
Can I get a bootleg copy?
Sorry. Checked out LimeWire. There's a version of it up there already,
Man.
Oh, man.
Really lovely.
Wow.
Excellently good.
Wow. Where on LimeWire? No.
You won't want it, I promise you. Anyway, so that's it.
Well, that's great.
What about you? What are you doing?
I've been working on a Blu-ray DVD release of a movie that's not even out yet, and I can't really talk about it because it's not my place to announce this thing, but I will just tell you that, HD DVD Blu-ray thing, Blu-ray does some really cool stuff. There's some really great interactivity that I've never seen before, that's going to be coming out on this feature, and there's some really cool things. So I don't know if special features matter to anybody out there listening, I know Blu-ray does some really unique things, picture-in-picture, live picture while the movie's going on, just some amazing things. So you're going to see some pretty interactive DVDs and Blu-ray DVDs coming out.
I see Toast 8 now does Blu-ray.
Does
it? I just downloaded a new version of it.
Yeah. I don't know who's going to win that war. it just keeps on, going back and forth, But
I'm still pulling for Beta.
Hey,
Beta's going to make a comeback.
I'm ready.
All right, guys. Well, this is going to be coming out the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, so I just want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving.
I say go.
And I have a note from all the turkeys. Have ham.
All right. Well, if you have any questions for the podcast, any of the guys here, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Or you can visit our MySpace page. That's myspace.com/audionowcast. And just drop us a line there. So, Ken, thanks. You did a great job engineering.
All right.
I did. Yay. Wake up, Ken.
And April's here. April, it's good to see you.
April.
All right. Well, from all the guys, we wish you happy holidays. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.